Dr. Meissner, Riedel 2.
Charlie Gupta was the chap responsible for culture at my school. I had my doubts about the communists by this time, and some of the doubts came from obvious self-damage. They decided at this stage that they wished to promote the children of the working and peasant classes, and that they wished to put people who had more advantageous backgrounds at a disadvantage, that they would make a selection at university and make higher education available essentially to those who came from the working class and peasant class. And whilst I could see their points that they wanted to bring about a radical change in the constitution of the Hungarian intelligentsia, obviously this seemed to me unfair. And having been discriminated before as a Jew, I didn't really fancy now being discriminated against because I came from the middle class. But at this stage, this wasn't entirely as obvious yet. And at the age of 15, on the strength of the fact that I was so successful as being responsible for culture and having taken the school to all the great plays and things, I was appointed as instructor of the National Ballet Institute. And as such, I had amazing powers, and some of the pupils of the Ballet Institute were 16, 17, 18, and I was only 16. I had access to the headmaster. I could discuss the curriculum. I had most amazing powers. Then eventually I was called in at 16, and somebody told me that we hadn't reached the point that the plutocracy should run the Hungarian communism. So I lost my post, and perhaps this was all for the best in my case, because it meant that I could get down to studying and concentrate on becoming a doctor, which I was intent to do. And instead of paying communists, I could forget about it all and could return to more reasonable pastimes. However, it made me look at the Hungarian communist regime again. And I realized that Mr. Rákosi and his regime, which he was running, was a dictatorship of the worst kind. And it was oppressive. It moved people out from living in the capital to the country simply because they didn't approve of their politics or of their class background or what have you. They promoted their own people to posts which should have had nothing to do with politics. And they demoted people who were excellent for political reasons. It seemed by that time, not only because of my personal dissatisfaction or my rejection of my post, that this was a bad regime for Hungary. I decided to study Italian because the British Embassy became unsafe to visit. We used to visit the British Embassy to see films, but it became unsafe to visit. I was studying English, so I used to go there. And so the Italian Institute, for some reason, was a safe haven. So I studied Italian and went there. And I won a scholarship to Perugia. I was trying to get a passport. And I was told that this was ridiculous. People didn't get passports. And of course, I had never been outside Hungary until I eventually left at the age of 20. One started to be aware of the restrictions the regime imposed upon him. And it became obvious that this regime had major faults. It became obvious to everybody. And indeed, the tenability of the regime became doubted. And fortunately, in 1953, Rákosi lost power to Imre Nagy, who was also a dedicated communist, but we talk in England about one-nation conservatism. He was perhaps a one-nation communist. He didn't want to cultivate such a very divisive regime as the particular Hungarian version of the dictatorship of the proletariat was under Rákosi. And I can thank Imre Nagy for having ever got to university, because without him, probably I would have been executed on the basis that I came from the middle classes. So the election of Imre Nagy as the party leader and the prime minister in 1953 made a major change to Hungarian communism. Unfortunately, it wasn't to last. Rákosi managed to collect all the hardliners and eventually managed to torpedo him and lodge as prime minister, and he was replaced by a succession of Hungarian ultra-left prime ministers, ultra-left communist prime ministers. But the movement which started under Imre Nagy could not be altered. The search for democracy, for more freedom, was there. The writers had activity groups, the students had activity groups, and everybody was dissatisfied. It became very obvious that the hardliners were few and were relying very heavily on the Russian arms for maintaining power. There were meetings all over the place. We all knew that it couldn't last. But really, the time when it became very obvious was in 1955. And I was at that time, I was first year medical student in 1954-55 in Pécs, in provincial Hungary. And at that time, I didn't notice much change. Obviously, the regime was unpopular, but there was no obvious activity. It was a dull, oppressive communist regime, but everybody knew that this or that can't be said. But the movement wasn't very overt to try to throw over the regime. But when I moved back to Budapest for my second year at medical school in 1955, people started to speak much more openly, and people felt that the situation was untenable and that they didn't want to live with it anymore. Among my own friends, we ignored most of the activities, but there was a lot of activity among writers, actors, people who wanted to travel and couldn't, and people were unhappy about the economy as well, and unhappy about the oppressive ways the government was running its affairs. By the time I was a third year student, in the autumn of 56, it became obvious that international events were happening which destabilized the communist regime. I mean, first of all, there was the death of Stalin, of course, 3 years before, and Khrushchev openly criticizing the Stalinist regime. Now, his criticism of Stalin's regime meant that people could criticize and recognize that Rákosi's regime was something very similar to Stalin's and was closely related to it. So the reliance which the Hungarian ultra-communists faced on Soviet support was no longer available to them. Gomulka in Poland was openly critical of Stalin and of his predecessors in Poland. There was some movement in Poland. And eventually this movement in Poland in 1956 was that precipitated the Hungarian Revolution. What happened was that there were activities in Danzig, in Gdynia, in Poland, under Gomulka, and the Hungarian students decided to organize a demonstration in sympathy with the Polish events. And this was the famous event of October the 23rd, 1956, almost 40 years ago, which I went on, and I just met up with all the other students who decided to go on this demonstration. And we met at Petőfi's statue in the early afternoon, and we walked as an orderly crowd across Budapest, crossing the bridge, the Margit Híd, to the Bem tér, where a number of leaders of the revolution read out the 10 points that they were demanding from the government, mainly pertaining to freedom of the press and freedoms for the individuals. And by this time, the Hungarian Prime Minister, then Gerő, who was the right-hand man of Rákosi, returned from a visit to Tito in Yugoslavia, and having heard of this demonstration, which was, I would describe it as a sort of a liberal left-wing demonstration for being mildly critical of events, trying to get a few more seats on the right, but certainly not at that time intending to overthrow the regime overnight. But Gary misjudged the situation, and he made a broadcast whilst the procession was on, calling this a fascist demonstration, trying to overthrow the regime. And I mean, obviously made a tremendous strategic mistake. And but even so, we got back from the demonstration at orderly day. And I remember I went home, and my parents were totally unaware that there was anything very much happening. This must have been 6 o'clock. And huge demonstration, and must have been 100,000 students, and all over Budapest, but even so, it didn't make a tremendous impression on people like my parents. They weren't aware of anything was happening. And I went on that evening to a medical meeting at the university. Now, the medical meeting at the university was in the Goya Bar, which was the main lecture theater for basic medical sciences. That's by the story I tell. And the spirit by then was completely different. The meeting was chaired by the president of the Hungarian Academy, a professor of medicine called Rusziák István, quite an internationally known physician. But the questions which came from the audience were to asking him how much was he paid for his collaboration with the communists. How could he, as a professor, agree on this, that, and the other? But quite clearly, there was a spirit in the air which wasn't accepting the Hungarian communist establishment, the way it had done its affairs. But even so, this was orderly, very civilized medical meeting. I, as a medical student, of course, was completely surprised that, you know, here was somebody, a great man, being questioned in that manner. But the whole meeting had a hostile atmosphere, which quite clearly showed that people were deeply dissatisfied with the leadership. And then firing broke out. And this building was very near to the headquarters of the Hungarian radio building. It's in Sándorce, Bódi Sándorce, just next to the National Museum. And there were some bodies brought in with one I remember was shot in the neck. And I searched for them to try to do a tracheostomy, but I was only a third year medical student, and it became quite clear that there were a lot of qualified surgeons there. So I couldn't eventually get quite access to the body of the injured person. But there was blood. And some people came in that, I think calling us comrades even then, and saying, comrades, your friends are being murdered at the radio building. And there were more bodies brought in. I think what happened that some of the demonstrators went on to the radio building and demanded that the decisions of the meeting and banquet of the procession should be read through the Hungarian broadcasting of the Hungarian radio. And the secret policemen who were guarding the radio building lost their nerve and opened fire on the crowd. And these were the people who were brought into this medical meeting, as that seemed to be the nearest place to get first aid. We wondered what was going to happen, and it seemed almost impossible to bring a regime down. And I don't think that we were thinking of bringing the regime down. We were trying to think of getting something broadcast, getting a few minor points over. But the Hungarian army appeared at this stage. We were in the street by this time, quite near to the radio building, and the Hungarian tanks appeared. And there were the chaps, Hungarian soldiers, standing in the tanks. And we were trying to find out from them what they were going to do, and they were trying to find out from us what was happening. Anyway, the net result was that the Hungarian army decided not to side with the secret policemen defending the radio building, but they gave help to the crowd. So I went with a friend at that time to sit down in the neighboring restaurants and had a drink and tried to evaluate the situation. But others went on that night to the statue of Stalin and pulled it down. And quite clearly the regime collapsed overnight. But the crowd was furious, but at the same time joyful. Next morning was an interesting one. The regime called in all the popular characters whom they thought were popular with the people, like the sports broadcasters and others. And they were trying to make appeals to the people that why upset things. But it became very clear to us all that the regime collapsed overnight. And then things happened in an orderly way. My parents were, of course, terribly afraid that in Hungary a crowd movement of this nature would result in some sort of anti-Semitic manifestations and that sort of thing. But in fact, nothing of the sort happened. People were united in their feelings that this was a good thing, we had to get rid of the oppressive communist regime, and in fact, in Hungary, by its natural inclination and fact, if possible, should be neutral, some sort of socialist, social democratic country standing between the West and the East. And that is the sort of way we saw the future of Hungary. Certainly we knew that we didn't want to have the Russians there. We thought that the Russians had done their job in defeating the Germans and driving them out of Hungary. We felt that we thanked them for that enough. We didn't owe them anything anymore, and we didn't feel any particular fraternity or alliance with them, wanted to part with them. At government level, which wasn't at that time that far, maybe with the half an hour from Parliament and things, but things were happening. And the shift was recognized within the government, and they thought that if they realigned themselves slightly, they could save the regime. And so, rightly, they appointed Imre Nagy, who was perceived to be much more popular than any of the other discredited people. And Gary and others were flown out of the country by the Russians. And at this time, the Russians were in genuine quandary of what to do. They came in, Russian tanks, but then they went out again. And I think, speculate looking back on this so far away, but Khrushchev must have been initially a serious doubt whether should he let the Hungarians do what they want to do, or should he go ahead and crush this revolution. And I think that they were making all the preparations for crushing the revolution, but they weren't sure yet if they were going to act, they were going to watch it, which way the revolution was going to go. And these were heady days. One was absolutely delighted at the collapse of the regime. One was wondering what sort of regime one wanted. And there were, of course, genuine anxieties. There were those who were afraid, and I presume anybody associated with the secret police would have been afraid. And people started sort of identifying those who were particularly committed to the regime and started to think of secret police people. But I didn't notice any particular vengeance at that time that people would have felt. I carried on with my activities at the medical school in committees, and I was given a mission to collect some medicines from Chopin from the Hungarian border. So I went down with three lorries, and there were international rescuers and Red Cross bringing over medicines to support the revolution in case we needed any medicines. There wasn't much shooting at that time. And that's what I did. I went down. I noticed that the border was open, and these people delivered us their medicines, and we drove them back with the three lorries and deposited them at the medical school. And see afterwards, we wondered that where were we heading and where were we going. And we had a German journalist staying at the house in the Boca Flats where I went. And his car, it was obvious that there weren't many cars anyway, but he was the German registration number. He was writing for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. And as things happened, and Imre Lodge was making his appeals, I managed to get out of the country with this German journalist who drove me out. And as the Russians were coming in, we were going out. Just in time, because when we got to near Hegesholm, the Russians had already closed the border at Hegesholm, so we couldn't get through there. But fortunately, we managed to get to a hospital in Moshomayarova, where I got the inspection room, and the German and I stayed there. And then we found eventually a crossing place. We picked up another German chap who came on the Red Cross. And the three of us crossed over and got to Vienna. And by that time, his grandmother of mine, I spent the time in during the war, was she got her house back in Vienna, she got a flat there. And I got to the beginning of November. And the Russians were back in power in Hungary. The fighting went on. I was no longer there at that time, so hence I say to you that I was involved with heroes who went up fighting after the revolution. But it was one of the great moments in one's life that, due to a popular move with an unhappy and oppressive regime, it was possible for the people to bring down a government which they didn't like.
You seem to have taken quite an early decision, maybe in early November, to leave the country. Does that mean that you quickly appreciated that the revolution was going to fail?
Yes, I think it does mean that. As an unusual situation, I went to Sopron, as I told you, to collect these medicines at the border, and then I just realized that how near it was and how available it was. I had a grandmother who lived in Austria and who had a house in Vienna. And so when things were going badly and it was clear that the revolution, at least temporarily, was going to have an enormous setback, it seemed still possible that the Russians were going to pull back after the invasion. But I had a little discussion with my parents, and their view was that I ought to sit it out in Vienna and stay with my grandmother. And if things worked out all right, then I'd come back. If not, I'd stay longer. It wasn't absolutely clear. But also it was an opportunity of having this correspondent at the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung staying in the house. And he's going back as the Russians were coming in. So it seemed an opportunity. And I decided to take it. And I obviously haven't regretted taking it. I don't think that for a moment I thought that we could fight the Russian tanks successfully for any length of time. But I thought at that time that it would have been possible for the Russians still to change their minds and perhaps allow eventually the revolution to succeed. It didn't seem to be completely out of the question. So I didn't leave with the idea of leaving forever, but I thought I would leave for some time.
The Hungarian communists and the Russians made great play with the idea that there was a danger of Arrow Cross or fascist takeover in October, November 56. What do you think about that?
I didn't think of this as a serious... I had every confidence in my fellow citizens that they would be reasonable and that they would behave normally. And the behavior pattern that emerged during the revolution was not in those directions. I think that perhaps they wouldn't have been kind to those who had exposed themselves in a big way during the communist regime, and I suspect they would have had a go for the number of members of secret police and people like that. I didn't myself think that the direction that they were going to go would have been towards a revival of the Arrow Cross or having a fascist movement. Naturally, I think now, and I thought it then, that there would have been people who would have felt like that, but not many, and they wouldn't have had a significant impact. And people of my parents' generation were more concerned with that. I think young people like myself who have been in the Hungarian army and have been students with other students certainly weren't fearful of my own contemporaries in any way. And it was my own contemporaries who were the people who were the revolutionaries.
You talked about your participation in that initial student demonstration. How much organization was there behind that?
Quite a lot of organization. The organization didn't come so much from the medical school as from the engineering faculty. There was organization during the revolution in the medical faculty, and I participated in a number of committee meetings and others. And that was quite interesting. It was mainly concerning itself towards collecting medicines from the border and other things. We weren't really the avant-garde of the revolution. You very kindly asked me if I would be able to give you some directions of where you would find those, and I certainly did after a little bit. There are some of us in England who were on the avant-garde. I wasn't. However, as I say, it's... what I did participate in, I feel, still were the highlights, the high moments of my life.
But when the first demonstration took place, where did you assemble to start off with?
On the battlefield there, you know, just by the bridge. And we just went there, like everybody else, at 2 o'clock, because we knew that there was going to be a demonstration. And then we went through the Bajicinski, the Margit Heat, the Bantir, and then we came back on the same route, and I disassembled just as we walked very near to our house, which is just near the opera.
But how did people know to assemble at that point? Was it just word of mouth or leaflets?
No. There were notifications that this was going to take place, and there were